All right, then. So, Monday, we were talking about the fact that pre-Brexit, the financial markets didn't do a very good job of anticipating outcomes, and if conventional wisdom is to be believed, the reason the markets had gone up prior to the election was an anticipated result that Hillary Clinton would be elected, and that turned out to be incorrect, and the markets then substantially declined, which I found interesting and I think correctly anticipated that they would correct pretty quickly, in the sense that it's not clear why a major business in the United States would necessarily find Donald Trump's election to be problematic. His platform has been removing government regulation, making things easier for business, increasing infrastructure investment, probably defense spending, and so forth. So the reasons for that from a strictly business standpoint, of course, we're here in the class of trade. We'll get to that in a minute. So one would infer there will be some trade effects. But again, we were discussing in relation to figures we've been looking at with respect to the TPP and others, compared to many economies, the United States is less dependent on trade for its GDP and GDP growth as many other countries, say, for example, Germany. So the trade impact, so the impact of changes in trade policy is likely to be less dramatic. Not entirely unreasonably, based on what we know, the market snapped back already by the opening of business and now markets are actually up in the United States. Whether they'll close that way at the end of the day is anybody's guess, but it hasn't had the kind of dramatic market effect that happened overnight, particularly in Asia. But one thing I think it does do, again, this is just general speaking, but it has to do with the course, I suppose. There's been a long-standing, we'll call it at least a myth of markets, that financial markets and international financial markets, it's very difficult to beat the market because they are very efficient processors of information and essentially have already discounted future developments with what is typically almost referred to as perfect knowledge, which, because of all of the information that's captured by various market actors, so that the markets do a very good job of anticipating outcomes. I think both with respect to Brexit and with respect to the election, it really, if one didn't have a reason to doubt the perfect information theory before these elections, one would certainly have reason to doubt it afterwards, which may encourage you to speculate more in the stock market, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. I encourage you to do that, in fact. But so that is some interesting elements of that. With respect to trade, so this is a very interesting problem set. So, for example, I'm going to go back. The very beginning of the course, right? The first two readings I gave you. One was a reading about kind of the new trade economics, and the other was a reading raising the bridges. The initial article about the new trade economics was precisely making the point that, you know, despite the points of old Samuelson and Adam Smith economics about trade, you know, raising all boats and so forth, there's been a new current in trade theory, which was looking at, for example, the article we first looked at, was saying that as countries have very aggressively used trade policy as a strategic tool, as in China was the particular, you know, one of the key examples in the first one, and are able to embed first mover advantages in a way that can really work to the long-term disadvantage of certain trading partners, which was pointing a little bit to U.S.-Chinese relations and Chinese use of trade policy as a strategic tool. You know, some of the old thinking about trade adjustment and, you know, how trade raises all boats and so forth may actually not be as true as we once thought it was, and that's why the labor movement, for example, has said, you know, well, we aren't getting the benefits that you promised us we'd get because, for example, if someone really targets an industry like the steel industry and is able to embed a very large-scale industrial advantage in a particular area, it can become very difficult for somebody else to get that back. And that tied in then to both political, because it has to do with migration and other factors that went into the second piece, which was in The Economist, about raising the drawbridges. I mean, that was Brexit, and that's been kind of the current trend, is thinking about it last night. How do we look at this as a cycle, right? Well, when did the cycle of internationalism really start, the current one? Well, really, probably at the end of the middle of the 1940s, right? It was a post war policy, strong policy preference towards this idea of globalization and integrated markets and so forth. And so we are 75 years into this kind of cycle of globalization, and it's seemingly we're at least at a modest phase of cycling back from that kind of expansionary perspective on globalization. I don't think during the course of the course we've tried to suggest that somehow trade is a solution to all problems. It's an economic instrument, has some beneficial effects, but you also have the interesting distributional consequences, and so it's a relatively complex area. Now, so let's get to the president-elect. He started his policy platform with very strongly articulated view that, again, he picked on the NAFTA. The NAFTA's out there. I would not have considered, if I were going to say what our biggest trade problem was, I personally would not single out the NAFTA, but people understand the NAFTA. They know the NAFTA. I would have probably picked some trade relations with Asia rather than that, but, you know, to each their own about where our trade issues are. But in any event, that we've negotiated terrible trade deals, and that he would demand their renegotiation. Of course, that leads us directly, leaving aside the NAFTA for a second, that leads us kind of directly to today's discussion of what we started last time, right, which is the TPP, right? So the Obama administration has negotiated the TPP. We were talking about it last time, and the second part of the report was today's reading. And as we talked last time, I noted that, the numbers we've looked at, right? I mean, if you look at those numbers, right, 10-year effect, you know, 0.23% impact on GDP or whatever, or 0.23% GDP change one way or the other, you would hardly have the impression that that is something that all of our futures are going to collectively depend on, right? I mean, the International Trade Commission's suggestion is that the TPP is going to have a marginal impact on the United States, and one of the reasons for that is that, as we noted last time, it's because with most of the big actors in the TPP, we already have free trade agreements, right? So it's not going to have that kind of impact. The one country that we don't, the one big country we don't have a trade agreement with, bilateral free trade agreement, is Japan. So that is a pretty big deal. For the first time, the U.S. would have an FTA with Japan, and I think particularly you'd be looking at market opening for the United States in some areas of agriculture. But, again, to cycle back to a few comments I made last time, the real pitch of the Obama administration about the deal, I think, was more political and strategic as a counterweight to Chinese expansionism or prospective Chinese expansionism than really so much this is really going to affect the GDP of the United States because it's going to have some very big aggregate effect. Now, I talked about this a little bit in IP this morning. So this just raises point one, right? So Donald Trump didn't say, the president-elect didn't say, I'm going to throw out all trade agreements. In fact, I noted once before in response to a speech at the New York Economic Club, he referred to the WTO as a set of rules which, you know, he would have to bring cases, you know. I mean, he talked about the WTO as this thing that we use. He didn't say, I mean, I don't know what his view is really, but he didn't say my intention when I get into office is to withdraw from and abandon the WTO system. Maybe he has that idea, but he wasn't saying that. What he was saying is we've negotiated bad trade agreements. So, of course, I would say now it's a fairly foregone conclusion. I have anticipated, certainly, I thought President Obama might try to get the TPP through prior to the election, right? If you get the Chamber of Commerce, you get Congress people. And they were even talking about that 2-3 weeks ago. I think the reaction he got from the House of Representatives was, it's just not happening. You know? I mean, nice thought, but that's not going to happen. I just don't see how it could happen now, right? That before Trump comes into office, Obama's going to go to Congress and say, let's sneak the TPP through before the inauguration, because I just don't see the House of Representatives saying, you know, gee, that sounds like a good idea to us, but who knows, right? I don't know any better than you. It just seems unlikely. But, again, he didn't say, I don't want to have any trade agreements in the United States. He just said, the administration, the Democrats have negotiated terrible trade agreements. I reminded you that it was the Republicans who negotiated the NAFTA, so it was kind of an interesting argument. But, so, would it be surprising if he came in and said, well, the TPP's been negotiated, there's a text, and here's what I don't like about it. So let's all get back together and here's the United States' new demands about the TPP. And that stuff was already a little bit on the table before, right? The pharma industry was already unhappy with what they perceived as a short duration of biologics exclusivity. And so, you know, the president-elect wanted to say, I've now got us a much better deal. Of course, that is a very interesting question from a policy standpoint, but while I'm tempted to think that because he's been so negative about trade deals, at least the ones we've got, that the TPP would effectively be dead, I'm not so sure. I mean, he might well say, well, you know, really, I promised you better trade deals, so as soon as I'm in office, I'm going to go out and open up negotiations again to get this better TPP that I told you about. As to the NAFTA and Mexico, well, I just don't know what he plans to do about that, but because I'm really just not sure what he doesn't like about it. I mean, he hasn't, has he said anything specific? I'm not asking this cynically, I haven't heard anything specific about what he doesn't like about the NAFTA. So without understanding specifically what he doesn't like about the NAFTA, I'm not sure what it is. I'm not sure what it is that he would, or just walk away from it. I mean, we can do that too. I mean, but you know, then we just go back to WTO tariff rates, right? Bound WTO tariffs. So, I mean, even that, I would venture for you, vis-a-vis Mexico, would not be such a big deal at this stage, if you know, it all became subject to bound WTO tariff rates again. So I'm not sure exactly what would be going on with that. Maybe we'd stop allowing cross-border trucking? I don't know, really. But as I was going to intro to IP this morning, I was trying to think about IP policy, and that's what we're discussing here today. And I noted, right, that I served as an arbitrator in a trademark dispute that Trump was having, and had the opportunity, which most of you haven't had, to be fully briefed about the things that his organization does in terms of protecting its trademarks. And, I mean, it's not surprising. He's a very aggressive litigator on IP matters because his fortune today is largely based on licensing out his brand, right? So he's got a team of lawyers who bring lots of lawsuits involving the protection of the Trump brand. And I would guess, I have to say, I don't have insight into his thinking, so I'm just, you know. So I would guess this means he's got a view that says I'm in favor of strong IP protection, at least for trademarks and branding on my hotels, and in case I was involved the names of his hotels, and copyright his books and publications and so forth, and so if that's true, and for example, Ambassador Froman, I had mentioned to you when talking about the PPP, said, "Well, what the IPC report said." His reaction to the IPC report. So USTR is making a big deal out of the PPP, and the IPC comes out and says, "Well, in percentage terms, it doesn't amount to a hill of beans." And he says, "Well, that's because they haven't made a big deal enough about strengthening IP protection. Right? Their model doesn't account for that, although they say it does, right?" So, but one could imagine that what he would try to do in a revised TPP is strengthen the IP provisions. I'm not sure we're going to look at it, how far there is to go with that. He's reached probably the max limit for most of the TPP negotiating countries. But again, that's not stuff I'd really favor because I don't think that's a particularly good idea, but I guess I can imagine that. So I don't know what's going to happen. But again, I think from an overall economic standpoint, it's hard to say right off. So he has a more protectionist view of trade and wants to promote domestic manufacturing and infrastructure building in the United States. And he might seek to increase, I'm not exactly sure how you do this, but
increased tariffs on goods that would come into the United States. Let's just randomly pick a country, China, right? So the way we're going to do that is to increase tariffs on goods coming in from China. And that might promote domestic manufacturing. We might increase our So the obvious way to do that, and we looked at the case, we looked at the Canada solar case. The U.S. could well increase its Buy America preferences. Right? That would be the standard kind of trade mechanism for increasing local purchases. It doesn't, I guess one could say that would increase local manufacturing if you raise tariffs and establish greater binational provisions that encourages local manufacturing. So all of that stuff is doable. And I would even venture, done in some degree of moderation, not necessarily a bad thing from a policy standpoint, if done, again, reasonably. What is the risk? The risk is that you start a trade war, and by that I mean, again, the system is based as one based on reciprocity. It's very difficult to say to other countries, I woke up this morning and decided I wanted to increase my local manufacturing, so I've decided to raise tariffs on imports from you and increase my local purchasing preferences. So you're saying that to Europe, and the Europeans not saying, oh, well, okay, but I guess that means we're going to raise our tariffs on goods that you export and increase local preferences with respect to our own goods. What is the result then under standard trade theory? What is the consequence of that under standard trade GDP theory? Kind of the converse of why we'd like trade, if we like it.
You have inflation and the bilateral treaty system that collapsed, and then we wouldn't have all the trade.
Well, forget multilateral policy things. I mean, just economically. What? Why would the standard trade theorists say that raising tariffs and increasing BI, by which I mean BUI, not BI, right? Because it could be that too. Why would raising tariffs and increasing binational preferences, what would the consequence of that be? Okay, right. So if you do that, right, what happens is you don't have the import, so you don't have the low-cost competition or the low-price competition, so your prices go up, your cost of manufacturing goes up. As you say, it, for whatever industry you happen to be doing that with, that takes a portion of consumer surplus and channels it to the local producers, and raises prices. At the same time, at least in the short run, should it help employment? To the extent that your local manufacturing exceeds your loss of export opportunity, right? So that's your problem, right? If the other side reciprocally raises barriers, then your exports go down. So it gets pretty complicated. So, standard trade theory tells you the reason you lower barriers is you want imports from abroad because they're produced at lower prices and they increase competitiveness and make you more efficient, therefore increase your output or at least global economic output. So raising barriers and increasing local preferences has the converse effect of raising prices because of an absence of competition and higher costs, particularly as you create as you would say, you might raise inflation because you're reducing the market for the products overall, and bidding up labor costs and so forth. But again, I would say that most things like that done in a targeted way with moderation, no single act like that is not likely to have a very dramatic effect. And to me, it's kind of interesting. I mean, for years, politicians in the United States, well, Barack Obama, what was his response to 2008, what did he want Congress to do? So he and the Federal Reserve together injected a lot of capital into the system to shore up the banks. What else did he want to do? So that was monetary stimulus. What else did he want to do? He wanted to do fiscal stimulus. He wanted to have big infrastructure projects. That's precisely what he went to Congress for. I want a very big infrastructure project so that we put people back to work. Right? So I want to put money in the system and I want to put people back to work. He wasn't able to get that. You know, the opposition party said, you know, no way. We're not going to spend money on things that we don't have the money for. Everybody in the United States knows that we need infrastructure improvements. So, I mean, as a matter of principle, at least me, I'm speaking for myself, if a politician wants to increase infrastructure spending in the United States, I think that's a good idea. And if the president-elect says I want to do that, and he's got a Congress that's all of the same party, and they all decide they're going to increase infrastructure spending, I'm not sure that's a bad thing from an economic standpoint, so that could be good. None of this has to do with the social policy aspects of what the election was about, and those are much different questions. But, you know, I am not so unoptimistic about the outcome from an economic standpoint. I think a lot of the president-elect policies were rather inchoate. I expect him to bring, I mean, almost by definition, to bring in a team that has a decent handle on how these things work, and you know, these are the kind of things politicians try all the time. From a trade standpoint, I think the one thing that history has suggested, yeah, is that it's not a good idea to have a trade war because that tends to create recessionary pressures and, you know, isn't a good idea, but whether some war. Again, because it's just very simple, right? If we say to China tomorrow, we're raising tariffs and imposing local preferences, or to India, you know, they'll say, okay, so will we. And then everybody's costs go up, the whole system becomes less efficient, global GDP goes down. Arguably, I'm not suggesting there's an analogy, but that's what happened between the First and Second World Wars, which is why we ended up where we ended up with today. So, you know, that on the whole isn't, I think, a good idea. But, you know, until we see what happens, I tend to think it's probably not going to be as bad as the doomsayers might suggest. But any thoughts about that? I'm not trying to make it. It's a class about trade, not politics. So any thoughts about the trade consequences of the election? You what? Huh? Well, it's possible. It is entirely possible. But, you know, I just take you back because
you guys aren't even nearly old enough for this, but I mean, when Ronald Reagan was elected back in 1980, that was a big thing back then. That was a guy who'd been an actor and, you know, head of a actors guild, and yes, he was California governor, so he had some political experience, but there was no precedent really to Ronald Reagan being elected, and he was, you know, widely regarded as an affable fellow who everybody liked, but, you know, not a rocket scientist or whatever, and you know, we managed to get through that. Go ahead.
I know that we saw George W. Bush unsigning treaties, whatever that means. We don't really even know what it means today. How would he do something like withdraw from the NAFTA if he really wanted to? You know what I mean?
You just give notice. There's
give
a
notice, and that's it.
Well, so let's stop for 1 second and think about that, because
so strictly speaking, this has actually been an issue under U.S. law, but it's never really come up in a way that's been resolved by the courts. So I don't want to. I can't say that I've got an answer for this that's categorical, but it's the same thing as we were just looking at the Brexit triggering. The president required the approval of Congress to ratify the NAFTA. Does the president require the approval of Congress to withdraw from the NAFTA? Thoughts?
Well, it's been like Brexit already, so. Maybe
the same way,
but he does need
the
consent of Congress.
And a bit like Britain, and even more so in this case, I don't want to get, I don't know. I would be tempted to suggest it's mainly an abstract question, because if he went to Congress and said, let's withdraw from the NAFTA under the current climate, they'd probably say, yeah, good idea, although I'm not so positive about that, but, you know, you don't know. So,
oh, by the way, the Supreme Court in Britain, I think it was yesterday, or the day before, I don't know, did grant, effectively, cert the Brexit case. So the Supreme Court is taking it. I'm going to speculate that because Congress, in the specific matter of trade agreements, has the regulatory power over commerce with foreign nations and approved the NAFTA, I'm going to say that Congress would have to approve the withdrawal from the NAFTA, and that it's not something the president can do simply on, I can say his now, his own prerogative. But, I mean, I don't think there's an ironclad answer to that, because I know that it has come up in a academic way, right? Academics have asked, you know, can the president withdraw from a treaty without the consent? But you would have a different, you have two different questions, one under kind of a defense treaty in which you have like an anti-ballistic missile treaty, even though it was approved by the Senate, you can make the argument that because the president's the commander-in-chief and has the general foreign affairs power, he could serve notice on Russia that we're withdrawing from the AVM treaty without the approval of the Senate. I think probably in terms of the NAFTA, because it's a foreign commerce treaty that so we can see whether there's anything about it in the statement of administrative action. Because, as I said, the executive might have bound the administration to how withdrawal would be undertaken. But that said, I mean, that's a bit early, right, in the sense that logically, what the administration would do would be to notify Mexico that they wanted to renegotiate, or Canada, I guess, too. I mean, he hasn't really talked about NAFTA as Mexico. Notify that we want to the NAFTA prior to serving the notice of termination. Anyway, but yes, I do know the NAFTA has a provision for withdrawal and termination. So, well, we're going to find out. There's a lot of things that we don't know yet, and as I say, obviously the social sides and economic sides are different, but we will see. Okay, well, so